He has a selective memory. And most of these situations, most of this activity is just like second nature to him. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't register at all, which is horrifying because the psychological damage it does on people who are sexually abused is tremendous. But for him, he likes women. He thinks he likes women. He likes dominating women. And he likes, but the real gist of it right now is he can't see past the aging process. So he looks at E. Jean and she's a late 70s lady, and he can't see what she looked like or see the beauty in her face right now. It's stupid, but that's part of our society's problems too.
And also this continually saying she's not my type. He's not my type to sexually abuse. I mean,
that's
as we
right.
all know, rape and sexual abuse has everything to do with power and not
yes.
to do with attraction.
Jessica yes.
Leeds, when we interviewed you, I always remembered you talking about the effect afterwards. I mean, you weren't even sitting in first class. The flight attendants came to you sitting right in the back and said, you can sit up here. And that's how you ended up sitting next to this man, Donald Trump.
That's correct. Yes, that's correct.
You said you never wore a skirt again on a flight?
That's right. That's right. Well, and I'd have to say, what was it, a week ago, there was a report of a man putting his hand up the stewardess's skirt. To this day and age, I mean... This continues.
Jessica Leeds, do you hope that this will inspire other people to come forward, not only accusing Donald Trump, but especially, for example, this law in New York, though it doesn't have to be just this law, but the Adult Survivors Act that goes through the one-year look-back where a sexual assault survivor can file a case, this one-time period of time. Do you hope people who have been victims of sexual assault and rape will come forward now?
The wheels of the justice system moves so slowly. That's a tough call. I really don't know how useful that is to encourage people who have been sexually abused to take that route. I would just wish that in our society, we could address this issue, talk about it, do some research, and help the survivors. You might even look upon this as a form of, we send men off to war and come back and they've got PTSD. Well, how about women who've suffered sexual abuse getting some counseling and help and whatnot for that? That's what I think.
Jessica, I wanted to play for you Trump's attorney, Joseph Tacopina, standing on the steps of the courthouse yesterday after the verdict came down.
You know, we're in one sense gratified, and I know some people in this camp are very happy that, you know, the rape claim was rejected, but, you know, I'm not, and I am happy about that, certainly, but I'm not happy that he was found liable for anything whatsoever.
He wasn't fully committal on this, saying, well, at least Donald Trump wasn't found guilty of rape. So there were three choices in battery. One was rape, one was sexual assault, and the third was unwanted sexual touching. Your response to that point, though, interestingly, Donald Trump hasn't made it very much. Clearly, he understands the significance of this decision by a civil court coming down unanimous, six men, three women, finding him guilty of sexual assault as he runs for president again. But your response to that?
Well, the lawyer, who is very aggressive and could be described as a bulldog, is doing his best to represent Trump. I hope he gets paid. But and how much this is going to affect Trump's core, who are unfortunately cult-like in their devotion. I don't know how much this will help, but if it helps Xi Jinping and it brings the topic out for discussion and coverage, okay, I'm satisfied.
And final question, the issue of this being a civil trial, so in fact, the difference between being found guilty and being found liable?
That's what I mean about going to the justice system. There are people who are going to equate the fact that he wasn't convicted, and they got confused over charges and whether who was who and who was defending and who was prosecuting. It got pretty confusing. So we need to go back to civics class. But I think this was a good outcome, and I'm very thankful.
And I'll just ask a last question. You came out before President Trump won election in 2016. As did well over a dozen women. Was it 20, more than 20 women?
Yes.
He was elected president. Now he has been found liable for sexually assaulting a woman in a department store dressing room. He's running for president again. Your thoughts?
Again, he has a core of people who will vote for him. The truest thing he ever said was he could stand at the corner of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and it would not lose any votes. That is so true. I just hope that the rest of the world can see through and know that we need somebody much, much better than this to manage the country.
Jessica Leeds, I want to thank you for being with us. She is one of two witnesses who testified in E. Jean Carroll's case about their own experience of Donald Trump sexually assaulting them. She told jurors about how she sat down on a plane next to him in a flight in the 1970s and how he groped her. Moira Donegan, I also want to thank you, opinion columnist for The Guardian, writer in residence at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University. We'll link to your pieces on this case. Coming up, we speak to the Salvadoran poet and writer, Javier Zamora, author of the best-selling memoir Solito, about his 4,000-mile journey without his family from Salvador through Guatemala, Mexico, to the Sonoran Desert of Arizona as a 9-year-old. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday at midnight, the United States will end the pandemic policy known as Title 42 that's been used by the Trump and Biden administrations to block nearly 3 million asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border. Some reports indicate there are as many as 150,000 migrants on the Mexican side of the border who hope to apply for relief as soon as possible after the policy is lifted. This is a Colombian migrant who joined others at the border fence in the Mexican city of Tijuana Tuesday.
I'm like in limbo. Let's see what happens. I hope to be able to pass to the United States because I have a son there. He's 18 years old, and I want to be with him.
This week, authorities in El Paso and other U.S. border cities have carried out targeted operations against hundreds of migrants who already arrived and were sleeping on the streets outside overflowing shelters. President Biden said he spoke by phone Tuesday with Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador about border security issues.
I spent close to an hour with the Mexican president today. We're doing all we can. The answer is it remains to be seen. We've gotten overwhelming cooperation from Mexico. We also are in the process of setting up offices in Colombia and other places where you can, or someone seeking asylum can go first. So, but it remains to be seen. It's going to be chaotic for a while.
CBS News reports the Biden administration plans to launch new procedures for quickly deporting migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border as soon as today. Most asylum seekers will be required to request refugee status in another country like Mexico before reaching the U.S. Deported migrants would be barred from reentering the U.S. for 5 years. This week, over 230 groups sent an open letter to President Biden demanding he follow through on his commitment not to detain migrant families and to end for-profit immigration jails, writing, quote, "Detention places people in conditions known to cause mental and physical harm and endanger their lives. Detention is not a deterrent to migrants who have no choice but to flee dangerous or violent conditions in search of a better life," they wrote. For more, we're joined by Javier Zamora, a Salvadoran poet and writer whose New York Times best-selling memoir, Solita, tells the story of his own odyssey to the United States as a 9-year-old boy from Salvador across Guatemala, Mexico, and eventually through the Sonoran Desert. He traveled unaccompanied by his family, by boat, by bus, and by foot. After a coyote abandoned his group in Oaxaca, Mexico, in Oaxaca, Javier made it to Arizona with help from other migrants. He's also the author of Unaccompanied, a collection of poems about his experience migrating to the United States as a child to reunite with his parents. Javier Zamora, welcome to Democracy Now! It's an honor to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about your own personal journey, which is so powerful and so important to understand, I'm wondering if you can respond to what's happening, to President Biden saying it'll be chaos at the border for a time, to the pandemic era, Trump Title 42 policy being lifted tomorrow night at midnight, and what this means.
I think it's always been chaos, right? I don't think that this will fix anything. Things will get worse. Things are already really bad. And I just can't help to think of all the people waiting, all the people that will continue to wait, and all the people who are still fleeing for their lives from all over Latin America and the world. And I would just hope that this presidency and any future presidencies will treat immigrants like actual human beings.
So let's talk about that journey that so many have taken through so many countries by you telling your own story. Can you start by telling us about where you were born in El Salvador, and how you ended up coming to the United States? Take us on that journey of your life.
Well, I was born in 1990 in the small fishing rural village of El Salvador called La Herradura. And, you know, I was born during wartime. And because of the Salvadoran Civil War that started in 1980 and in 1992, my dad fled in 1991. The war ended, but the war didn't end at the same time. So my mom left my country in 1995,
Javier,
and I was left at the care.
I'm only interrupting for a moment, because before you take us on that journey, If you could expand more on when you said your father left, you're talking about a country where the U.S. backed the military in Salvador, well known for killing thousands of Salvadorans. Can you give us a picture of what that U.S. policy meant? Because I think that is what is so absent from so many discussions as people now try to make their way to the United States.
You know, at one point, only Israel was getting more money than El Salvador in the 80s, and we're talking millions of dollars a day. And before the U.S. got involved, the left was winning. And what the left wanted was equality, women's rights, and education. And because of those asks, my dad was a leftist, and he was the head of a co-op. One of his older brothers was disappeared by the military in 1980, and the violence was everywhere. And because of those reasons and because of his ideological leanings, he had to flee in 1991. And same with my mom. You know, it is still difficult in my country in 2023 and also in this country being a woman. There's a lot of gender-based violence. And because of, you know, you were talking a lot about sexual assault, and that is everywhere. And that was a huge reason why my mom also fled the country.
And so you were, what, 1 year old?
I was one when my dad left, and I was five when my mother left.
Being raised then by your grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about them deciding for you to take this journey and how you traveled.
You know, the moment that my dad left, we would communicate via letters and phone calls. When my mom left, it was the same thing. And what they both told me was that they were going to come back. And we have to remember that in the brief period of time, El Salvador had peace. And that was, it lined up with my childhood. 1993 till 1999 was perhaps the most peaceful moment in my country's timeline. But in 1997, you know, people were beginning to get shot in my hometown, and my parents changed from, we're going to return to El Salvador, to you're going to come be with us in the United States. And so from 7, 8, and 9, I knew that I wanted to be reunited with my parents. What kid doesn't want to be and wake up next to his parents? And so I didn't really understand how I was going to get here or how dangerous it was for me to travel the 4,000 miles that I did. But what I did know is that I loved my parents and I really, really, really wanted to be with them.
So you went with your grandfather from Salvador to Guatemala?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So my grandpa accompanied me all the way to a border town called Tecumuman, which is still a very major crossing hub. And from then on, he gave me over to the coyote, a smuggler, and I wasn't the only one with him. I was part of a larger group of seven other immigrants, and he, the smuggler, was supposed to bring us to the United States in as little as 1 week from Guatemala. And of course, that doesn't happen.
And then your grandfather leaves, and talk about how you traveled on from there and the massive danger. I mean, you almost didn't make it to the United States. If you could then talk about going through to Mexico and what happened.
You know, I still don't know why my trip took the turns that it did. But the plan was for me to cross a river from Guatemala into Mexico. That was the original plan. But I have done some research, and already in 1999, the Mexican government was militarizing the southern border. And this is also continuing to happen now. And so because of that militarization, the coyote thought that it would be easier for us to cross into Mexico if we took a 22-hour boat ride from Guatemala to bypass Chiapas and land in Oaxaca. And that is what we did. But when we were supposed to get on the boats, there were news that three boats had capsized and immigrants died. And this is still happening in the southern borders, and people are trying to get over here. So that was my fiasco and like number one when I was so close to death. As a 9-year-old, I didn't really understand it as such. What I understood was that I couldn't swim, and that I was scared of sharks, and I was scared of the night. So those were my fears. In reality, I was very close to death on that boat, and that was my first day in Mexico. And when we land, we also face a checkpoint, which still happen daily all over Mexican states against Central Americans and other immigrants. And because of those checkpoints in 1999, we were dragged out and robbed by the Mexican military. And from then on, it was weeks until we meaning the group of six other immigrants, until we figured out how to make it to the Sonoran Desert and the U.S.-Mexico border.
So talk about crossing the border and what it meant to be in the Sonoran Desert. I mean, you have obviously a very different experience right now living in Tucson, Arizona. But what it meant to cross and then to be there, to survive in the hot, parched desert.
You know, similar to the boat, as a kid, my 9-year-old brain didn't—I think subconsciously I knew how close to danger I was. But in the front head of my brain, I was like, oh, look at this weird plant called a cactus, and I'm really thirsty. I don't have food, but if I keep on walking, my parents are at that finish line. So that's how I understood this as a 9-year-old. All the adults around me, by that point that we made it to the U.S.-Mexico border, it wasn't only the six. There were immigrants from Ecuador. There were immigrants from Cuba. There were immigrants even from Brazil at that time, who we all joined together in a group, I want to say 50-plus. And each try, which it took me 3 tries to cross the Sonoran Desert, we suffered a lot. You know, the first time we were apprehended by Border Patrol, and I spent two nights or one night, because I blacked my incarceration up. I blacked it out. And so I spent either 48 hours in detention. And, you know, we hear about the effects of detention. I spent less than 3 days in there, and I still suffer PTSD from those few hours that I was there. And that was only my first try across the desert. The second time, we ran out of water, and we ironically were rescued by a Border Patrol agent after we needed to get water from a ranch. And we were released back into Mexico. And finally, the third time, we finally made it.
You know, you're bringing me back to a conversation we had during the pandemic with the family of Armando Alejo Hernandez, who had come up from Mexico to see his sons in Utah and left them messages and then died in the desert, in the Sonoran Desert. And so what you survived, Javier, is truly astounding. And when you think of how many thousands of people who have died in the Sonoran Desert alone, the artists that we traveled to in the desert who put up crosses for as many people as he could, who he learned about their names, this all being done in the name of U.S. policy of deterrence, your response to that, and also for people to keep in their mind, you were 9 years old.
You know, in my trips as a 9-year-old and in writing this book, which took me 20 years to even begin to process everything that I witnessed and everything that I've survived, in the process of writing this book, I realized that there were certainly people that died in each of the crosses that I attempted to get to this country. And it is because of them that I am here. And I just hope that anybody listening, anybody reading, and even the president himself, hopefully, just realize realizes that we're all just human beings trying to have a chance at a better life. And thank you to all those artists, thank you to all the writers, anybody who believes that, that us immigrants are more than our trauma and are more than what we're asking for. We're just human beings. Okay? Yeah,
and Javier, you convey this so powerfully and poignantly, both in your poetry and in this book, Solito. But let's jump forward to how you do convey this, how you became a writer. But first, tell us how you met your parents, how you saw them in the United States, and then who influenced you, how you came to be a writer through all of this trauma.
You know, I left El Salvador on April 6, 1999, and I finally met my parents on June 11, 1999. And I opened a door in Tucson, Arizona, which ironically is my home now. And I see two shadows. And I recognize my mom because she left me when I was 5 years old. And then I see this man behind her. And I knew how my father looked, or what my father looked like, from pictures. But pictures and reality are two different things. And so he was a stranger. And I think that's a metaphor for how I felt after not being around him for 8 years. And it took us a few, I want to say months, until I got comfortable with not only my dad, but with my mom being in this country. And I had to live with the fact that, you know, we were all undocumented. From 1999 until I'm 21 years old, I don't have papers and I can't return to my homeland. And I think that fact is a huge reason why I became a writer. And it was in high school that when Google becomes Google, that I Google Salvadoran writers. And the first name that comes up was Roque Dalton, who is a leftist writer who wanted to create a better El Salvador. And I start reading his work. And what really impacted me was that Roque Dalton spoke like us and he wrote like us, meaning the rural Salvadorans, not the elite Salvadorans who wanted to replicate Spain, Spanish, but he wrote like the people. And I hope that in both my poetry and my prose, I am in tune with our caliche, which is Salvadoran slang. And that's all I wanted when I was 13, 14, 15 years old, and I was searching for Salvadoran books. And I hope that my book now could speak to another 9-year-old Salvadoran, Guatemalan, Honduran kid who has immigrated or is thinking of immigrating to this country.
Well, Javier Zamora, we thank you so much for spending this time with us, Salvadoran poet and writer, author of the best-selling memoir Solito, also Unaccompanied, a collection of poems about his experience migrating to the United States as a 9-year-old child to reunite with his parents. Javier has been a Stegner Fellow at Stanford and a Radcliffe Fellow at Harvard and holds fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Poetry Foundation as well. We're going to interview him in Spanish after the broadcast, and we're going to post it on our Spanish website. You can go to democracynow.org and click right through. That does it for our program. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Sanjit Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Radio Goethe. Modern German music at its best. Every Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This is Radio Goethe.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.